Do not think that I have come to bring peace to earth, to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Now, I thought of starting this talk with a joke, but then I thought I'll have as much of your attention if I quote Jesus and quote one of his very extraordinary and deeply unsettling statements. Here's the Prince of Peace, who says, "I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." Now, we know why people reach for the sword. We know what the sources of conflict in the world are. And probably one of the last words said on this matter was about 4 centuries ago by philosopher Thomas Hobbes. He basically stated that main sources of conflicts between people are as following: 1, competition; 2, fear; 3, glory, or something like honor. Now, the first one, competition, makes people invade other people, countries, and properties for gain. The second does so for safety. And the third one does for reputation. Now, Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace. I've come to bring sword." So you might ask, did Jesus come to make things worse when it comes to our struggles that in which we engage about gain, about security, and about reputation? No, to the contrary. Now, on each one of these things, on gain, on safety, on reputation, here's what Jesus says. About the gain, he taught, "Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth." About safety, he said, "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." And I think one of his most frequent injunctions in the gospel is, "Fear not." Third, about reputation, he commanded, "If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn also the left one," the other one, right? We tend to think of this as non-retaliation, but actually what's at stake is honor. If somebody strikes you on your right cheek, normally they would be right-handed and they would strike you with the back of their hand, and this was considered to be particularly insulting. In other words, about gain, about safety, about reputation, Jesus did not care very much. Or he cared, but not in the way in which we do. So what was this sword of Jesus all about? One way to put it is to say it was really about love. Not the love quarrels that we often have and sometimes big love feuds, but about love for things that are most fundamental in our lives, about kinds of loves that actually orient our entire lives and orient all of our loves. Here's how he puts it, why it is that he sets a man against his father and a woman and a daughter against his mother. He says, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it." What's clashing here? What's clashing are our ultimate loves, our ultimate allegiances. Here it is, family, maybe tribe, maybe a nation, and versus Jesus. What's clashing also is a particular ways of life. Here, pleasure and self-preservation versus losing life in self-sacrificial love. And because our ultimate allegiances and ways of life clash, people also clash. Especially we clash if we, what I sometimes call, live under the same roof. And just about all of us these days tend to live under the same roof. How do we live with our conflicts? How do we live in situation in which we are cross-pressured in so many ways, in which we actually cannot exit the conflict because the very existence of us is such that it produces conflict. Not necessarily violent conflict, but it produces conflict. And so my challenge for us today is to ask the question, how do we go into the conflict zones following Jesus Christ? What does that mean? Two basic things, I think, need to be said about this. And one concerns the issues of ultimate allegiance, and the other one concerns the sword. So let's take this issue of ultimate allegiances. That is to say, that in our lives which we love the most. Now, differences about those issues, and there are profound differences about those issues among people in the world, among religions, among ideologies. There are profound differences also within the church itself about those issues. Now, the interesting part about those differences is that they cannot be settled easily. And they cannot be settled easily by appealing to something like clear facts of the matter, and then applying clear reasoning to the clear facts of the matter. And the reason why this is the case is that these things concern the very character of God, the nature of the good, they concern the ultimate direction of our lives, they concern what you can just put it almost this way, what is truly desirable. And we know that what is truly desirable is really more of a matter of heart than it is a matter of reason. Reason there, I think, follows the promptings of the heart. The heart wants what the heart wants, and the reason finds the way to get there, right? Something of that sort, it goes. That's true in our loves of ordinary things, but particularly that's true in the orientation of our lives, in the grand love of our lives, which pulls us and gives direction to where we are headed. These differences are often impossible to clearly settle. That's one about loves and allegiances. Second comment I want to make is about the sword. You can put it almost this way. In whose hands did Jesus put the sword which he brought? Well, certainly not in the hands of his disciples. He was a man of peace. His disciples were men of peace and not of sword. And after all, did he not say, whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me? He didn't say, whoever doesn't take up his sword and follow me is not worthy of me. You can put it almost this way. He did not put sword into anybody's hands. What happened is by sheer coming into the world, by taking space as an alternative way of living one's life, he created the conflict and created the conflict without the sword. And importantly, one central element of that conflict concerned precisely how does one resolve disputes that we have? How does one get to what one actually deeply wants? And the way of the world is you do it by reason, you do it by power. Jesus has, as we will see later, nothing much about against reason, but at the heart of his message lies the cross, not just as a means of salvation of our soul, but as the very way of existence which we have to follow. That's, I think, what brought sword into the world. Now, over the long periods of Christian history, Christians have been better at wielding sword than they have been on carrying the cross. There's a long history of Christian violence. Now, I'm not persuaded by those who claim, and there are such people who say, Christians are kind of the most violent bunch on the planet. In fact, there is a book that was a very small book. You can read it, but I'm if you want to. It's called The Body Count. And somebody has taken great religions and counted how many bodies they have left in the trail throughout their history. And the claim of that book that Christians have most bodies, dead bodies, to are responsible for them. I'm not persuaded. At the same time, you know, I grew up in former Yugoslavia. My father was a Pentecostal minister, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister, and we were under communists. They didn't particularly like us. But both my father and my grandfather thought that it was harder for Baptists and for Pentecostals at the time where there was alliance between the throne and the altar, when the major churches, Catholic or Orthodox churches, were in power, than under the communists. Christians are worse to their kind than the communists were in those settings. And then, so that's kind of physical violence, but then there's also something like, how would you call it? Intellectual animosity, or maybe a good term for that is intellectual abuse. There's a special term for that. And the special term for that comes in Latin, is odium theologicum, which is hatred of theologians. Now, they don't mean objective genitive, hatred for theologians. They mean, the phrase means hatred by theologians. So prevalent it was. I was reading recently about this, and then I came across the story of one of the very famous Protestant reformers, a close collaborator of Martin Luther. His name was Philip Melanchthon. He was one of the finest theologians of Reformation, but he said one of the things that he hopes to achieve after he dies, one of the comforts of death will be that he would be spared the attacks of theologians, of fellow theologians. We struggle when important things in our lives, when ultimate allegiances with the character of God are at stake. We struggle between religions, among religions, but we struggle also within the Christian faith itself. And one of the great questions that we have to face today, as we had to face it, I think, throughout the centuries, is what form does following of Christ take when it comes to our inner Christian and outer Christian theological and cultural debates? Put it differently, what does it take, what does it mean to take up your cross and follow Christ in terms of how we engage one another at the places where we most profoundly differ? I want to mention four things. One of them is about truth, love, courage, and humility. So first is seek truth. Now, we live in a post-truth society, but Christians are not post-truth folks. Christians are truth-seeking folks. They may not be truth-possessing folks, but definitely we ought to be truth-seeking folks. A friend of mine from Brooklyn has designed a t-shirt, and I wish I brought it actually with me and spoke in that t-shirt. It basically says there, post-truth US. And that's the kind of guy I am. I'm a post-truth kind of a guy. I think that's the kind of Christians ought to be, post-truth, which is to say truth-seeking. Now, if truth is against me, you might ask, and in the conflict situation, we always do. If truth is against me, why should I be for truth? Why should I not use truth, claims to truth, fake news, or whatever you want to call it, in order to achieve my ends, that which profoundly matters to me? And I think the response is Jesus Christ, the Word through whom all things were made, is Himself truth and is source of all truth. To follow Christ is therefore to seek the truth. To follow Christ is therefore to obey the truth. To obey the truth even at one's own detriment. And you know that in social relations, untruthfulness is always a form of injustice. There's no innocent untruthfulness. Any untruthfulness harms the other and undermines social trust. Seeking truth requires discernment, requires vigilance. Is what someone claims to be true, in fact, true? Is what I claim to be true, in fact, true? There's kind of asceticism about the search for truth. Seek truth. Second, love your opponents. Now, since it's very difficult to settle all our theological debates and debates about the nature of God and lives that we ought to live, often disagreements and debates turn into vituperative attacks and outright persecution. And we mentioned that earlier. Especially that happens when important economic, political, cultural goods are at stake. And those need not be great economic and cultural goods. They may be goods of a particular little clique of folks, you know, so where loss actually profoundly doesn't matter for the world at large, but it matters for this one or two people who are struggling. Christian faith calls us to love our enemies. This is the central, well, that's too strong. This is so central that if you take the love of enemies out of the Christian faith, you unchristian the Christian faith. In other words, it is an essential element of our faith. And we ought to love our intellectual enemies as well, to respect them as human beings, to seek their friendship. By the way, this little book, Body Count, that I mentioned to you, was commissioned by a very good friend of mine who still remains a very good friend of mine. It's a foolish book to have commissioned, and it's wrong, but he is my friend. And he's going to stay my friend, notwithstanding that crazy book. He needs me because of that. No. You know, I think Chesterton once said, I believe it was Chesterton who once said, we shouldn't let a quarrel rob us of good and productive argument. A quarrel blinds your eyes to the truth, right? But a kind of argument, proper argument, opens you up for it, and therefore loving you and respecting them, not allowing yourself to demote yourself, to stoop to quarrel, is fundamental for the sake of truth, too. So, to speak the truth and to love our intellectual enemies, I think requires a great deal of courage. Truth claims are forms of power, and Christians engaged in truth claims are always in this socially cross-pressured way. And when we are cross-pressured, it's so easy to falsify the truth, to spin our way into it saying what we want it to say, into kind of, as it says in the gospel, in the epistles, to tickle the ears of our hearers. Important thing, courage for Christian followers of Christ entails always suffering. Prophets suffered, apostles suffered, Jesus Christ suffered, and my great hero Martin Luther, with all of his warts, put it succinctly and very well. The entire Christian faith can be summed up in faith, love, and the holy cross, which is suffering. Finally, walking humbly. Boastful attitudes about our claims and superiority of the Christian faith and our own superiority of our own position is completely at odds with the Christian faith. We don't point to ourselves. Our faith is not our own. We point to Jesus Christ. The Christians find themselves, I think, always in the image of John the Baptist at the cross, who is pictured in one of the Grunewald painting at the foot of the cross, holds the Bible and finger pointing to Jesus Christ. Even more importantly, our very existence we owe to God, and humility is a way of living out truth. The entirety of who we are is a gift of God. What do you have that you haven't received? Apostle Paul writes, and response is nothing. Why do you then boast? As if it was yours, as if it wasn't given. Seeking the truth, loving the enemies, acting courageously, walking humbly. Now, can we do that? Is it possible to do that? Must we not spin the truth to help ourselves survive? must we not stick with our in-group and hate our enemies and opponents? Must not courage take the form of valor in the battle rather than suffering? Must we not, like some animal that is in danger, puff ourselves up rather than humble ourselves in order to survive? If in this way we follow Christ, will we not demonstrate to our opponents our own weakness and our own foolishness? Perhaps. Let me conclude by saying there's nothing more foolish. There is nothing more clearly indicative of weakness than the hypocrisy of claiming to follow Christ but taking refuge in the means that Caesar and this world use. To be a Christian is to trust, with the Apostle Paul, that God will make manifest that the wisdom of the world is in fact foolishness and that the power of the world is in fact weakness. To be a Christian is to strive to act out of conviction that Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ crucified is our wisdom, is our power, and to do so in the conflict zones that this world always was and always will remain. Why? Because the future does not belong to the powers of this world. The future belongs to the crucified Christ. Thank you.